The District Board of Directors meeting to order, this being April 1, 2020, 9 a.m. Director Corona, would you lead us in the flag salute, please?
Sure. Ready to begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
April, do we have any guests this morning?
Yes, we do. I believe they're on the phone.
Okay.
President Sullivan, do you want to take an inventory of who might be on the phone this morning?
Sure. Can we just have who's on the call with us this morning?
Director.
Welcome, Randy.
Thank you.
Anyone else? I'm sorry. Was that Jolene?
General.
Yes, good morning, well, that one.
Okay, who else?
General Counsel O'Neill.
Okay, all right.
And this is also
and
Danielle
who?
Coates.
And Danielle, welcome.
Danielle Coates.
Brian Powell.
Brian Powell.
Brian Corbett from Stratling, Special Counsel.
Oh, super.
Darren Mott from PFF, Municipal Advisor.
Okay.
And Brian Dietrich from Blair Concurrent.
Okay.
And I want to be sure I have
Go ahead.
That last one, the director saw them, was Chelsea Sharp.
Oh, okay. All right.
So just to go, I have Randy Record, Jolene Walsh, Chelsea Sarp from OMLO, Danielle Coates, Brian Forbath, Brian Dietrich, and then someone from PFM, who was that?
Darren Hodges.
Okay.
Okay, we'll go to agenda item one, which is public comments. We'll accept anybody that's on the phone this morning or anybody in the audience. That would like to make a public comment that's within EMWD's jurisdiction area. And you, if you do speak, it'll be 3 minutes, limited to 3 minutes. And hearing no one, we will proceed on to the executive reports. Paul?
Thank you, President Sullivan, members of the board, and those on the phone. Good morning. You have my written report. It's included in the board package. As you can see, we have instituted new social distancing techniques for the board meeting on the dais, and of course, where staff is sitting. I also want to let the board know that for the closed session today, we will be doing that in this room. So we'll be asked those who are not present in the closed session to leave the chamber, and we'll continue to have that in the boardroom here. And also that we will have lunch, but that will be provided in this adjacent kitchen, and then you can bring it back to your seat here, and we can eat from this location. So anyway, we're just trying to practice that social distancing in this current environment. On that topic, I did want to let the board know that we are continuing many of the work practices that we have implemented in response to COVID-19. I want to really recognize our staff for very effectively implementing the changes in the work practices and making sure that we're continuing to provide all the services to our customers at a really high level. At the present time, the district has approximately 270 of our 615 employees on what we refer to as paid work-at-home status. This includes staff members that are really not required to be physically present at the district to support core operations. For those employees who are here supporting core operations of the district, we have implemented a number of practices, including adjustments to work hours. We've adjusted and created new shifts, so there's less contact, and other practices we put in place to ensure social distancing and other employee safety. On March 19th, we communicated to the employees who are on paid work-at-home status and our other employees that we would continue this until April 6th. Obviously, at the present time, we're hearing from federal and state officials that the shelter in place and other orders have been extended beyond that point. What we are doing is now extending these work practices for our staff in 2-week increments. So essentially, we will be continuing on the paid work at home status and the other work hour and shift changes until Monday, April 20th, or as otherwise notified by the district. And again, I do want to emphasize staff has been really very productive and really working well given the constraints they're working under right now. Related to this, and I know the board's quite interested in customer payment and past due account data. We are currently analyzing the data that we're getting in. It's fairly early. Essentially, we really have a couple of weeks of metrics to look at. The analysis is also a little bit complicated because of the implementation of SB 998, where we had the extended shutoff periods and definitions of delinquencies. But nonetheless, we are able to pull out some metrics, and what we want to do is get a statistically significant kind of sample through this month, and then next month give the board a number of detailed metrics and a good report on what we're seeing. However, one metric that has kind of stood up initially here is that an increase in the past due payments of 61 days or greater. So these are aging accounts. Just if you look at the close of 2019, our aging accounts at 61-plus days were about 3.5%. In this last week, and as of March 31st, this has now jumped to 9.3%. So we have seen a very significant increase in that. But as I mentioned, we want to get statistically valid sample size and come back with some really good analytics that we can show the board, and we'll do this in May with a comprehensive report. On a past and ongoing activities, we had a really, I thought, very productive conference call with the United States Environmental Protection Agency yesterday. President Sullivan was also on the call, as well as staff and our representatives from our Washington, D.C. Advocates Office. And the purpose of the call was to discuss a potential new funding source for septic to sewer conversions, specifically in the Quail Valley area. U.S. EPA and Congress had authorized a new program for U.S. EPA. That was authorized December 20th, 2019, with a federal authorization of $225 million. And then there's also been a first-year appropriation of $28 million. But the program is the U.S. EPA Sewer Overflow Control Grant Program. Because it is a new program, EPA is putting together the criteria right now, eligibility criteria. And they, based on what they were thinking, the application of this would be more for the East Coast for combined sewer overflows, where they actually have the storm drain system and the sewer system commingled and potential mitigation of overflows for that. What we discussed during the teleconference and also had provided previous information to EPA was extending grant eligibility to very limited types of septic to sewer conversion projects, specifically the conditions that we have in Quail Valley and that we also saw in Enchanted Heights, where you have a condition such that when you get heavy precipitation, the septage from the sewer septic systems actually flows to the surface and flows into the drainage courses, and in the case of Quail Valley, downstream to Canyon Lake. So the U.S. EPA was very interested in this. They felt it was a unique application because of the surfacing septage, and they have asked us for additional information, which we offered to provide it. We're also going to engage the Regional Water Quality Control Board, who's assembled a lot of technical information on this issue as well, and get that to U.S. EPA. And they've also committed on the call to continue to interface with us as the program scope is developed. But we think this might be an exciting opportunity to bring in some federal money directly for the Quail Valley project. I want to let the board know that on March 30th, MET ceased the Savova settlement deliveries, and in large part that's due to the dry conditions in other parts of the state and the state water project. State water project allocation stands at only 15%. They are getting additional snowfall this week, we understand, and next week, but we don't see, and MET does not see, that allocation substantially changing this year. So the MET notified us that they were going to curtail deliveries, and they did so. But we have had a very good run of recharge, and kind of getting the final numbers. Through March 29th, our delivery water deliveries for this year was 6,466 acre-feet. And if you add that to the 16,649 acre-feet of pre-delivered water from last year, our 7,500 acre-foot per year delivery obligation from MET has been satisfied for calendar year 2020, calendar year 2021, and calendar year 2022. And in fact, it has allowed a pre-delivery of 614 acre-feet of water for 2023. So we are very well positioned with the groundwater basin. We're very fortunate, and I want to commend Jeff and his staff for when that water was available, maximizing our recharge abilities. Similarly, we continue to take water off the San Jacinto River intermittently. Diversions began December 4th for the into the Grand Avenue ponds. So we've diverted a total of 642 acre-feet this year. So we're also getting river diversions. And those river diversions continue and are permitted through June 30th. We have a maximum cap of 5,768 acre-feet, which we're certainly not going to meet. And lastly, I did want to mention one item. We're being extra vigilant, and Jeff and Dave Brown, who's here, and his staff, on paying attention to the lift stations right now, particularly with we're seeing these types of objects disposed into toilets instead of toilet paper, so the disinfecting wipes. Dave has done a good job. We are doubling the frequency in which we go to the lift stations to look and inspect the wet wells and the pumps. The concern is obviously ragging those pumps and overflow of those lift stations. But we've also complemented that with a very aggressive effort on social media. And, of course, April and her staff have done a great job on our social media pages. But it's interesting, US EPA even came out with a public announcement, an advisory, and there's a link in your report regarding the use of and warning Americans to be careful what kind of materials they flush down their toilets, specifically encouraging the flushing of only toilet paper and not disinfectant wipes or other items. So we're really getting input from the national level. And related to that, as I mentioned, the social media, one thing we've seen is a very substantial uptick in our social media activity and usage by our customers and others. In just kind of an example, we've focused again on two primary areas, flushing items down the toilet, as well as, of course, the safety of our water supply during the COVID-19 crisis. And we've seen a lot more social media engagement. I guess people have time, they're at home. So, for example, our Facebook posts this last week reached 14,549 people, and we saw 1,300 engagements. And by comparison, this time last year, I looked, and our Facebook posts were 1,335. So we've gone from 1,335 to 14,000. So I think we're feeling like we're really reaching people with social media. Again, April and Amanda in particular, who works on that, are really putting very punchy, interesting things on our social media feed. Our Nextdoor account, which was a platform we weren't on last year and we are on this year, we had 15,000 impressions this last week. So we're really seeing a lot of activity on the social media, and I think it's being very effective to get the message out to our customers. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'd just like to, again, say kudos to Israel and Amanda and the entire team, because I think we're doing a fantastic job on social media, and those numbers just reflect that we're penetrating to our customers with messaging, so, in a very challenging, difficult time. So, again, kudos to everybody and April Shaw for that.
Any other questions?
Yeah, no, I don't have a question. I just have a comment about yesterday's call with EPA. I thought your presentation was absolutely excellent. The people at EPA, whether they're in Washington, D.C., or it was EPA Region 9 out of Sacramento, were very engaged. To me, my impression was it looked hopeful on a couple of aspects that we can seek some funding for. But at the end, they were asking, you know, what are the three things that's affecting the district with this coronavirus thing? And I think that they were amazed that this district is still going forward on a full-time basis. We haven't laid anybody off. There are some things that we're doing, like the different things going into the wet wells in the sewer system and what we're doing to handle that. You know, you couldn't see their faces, but you could almost tell on the other end of the line that they were impressed as to what this district was doing. And I thank you, Paul, and staff for making sure this moves forward like it is. Thank you.
Any questions from anyone on the phone? Thank you. Appreciate the time.
Thank you. Go to agenda item 3. We'll accept a motion and a second for approval of items 3A through 3H, unless anyone desires to pull any.
I'll make that motion.
I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries unanimously with all five directors voting yes.
President Sullivan.
Chair, it's O'Neill fighting in here, but we need to do a roll call vote on all items today.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm sorry. Roll call vote?
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Rucker?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
President Sullivan, you also might want to see under item 2B if there's any deputy general manager.
I'm sorry. Yeah. No, I was so impressed with what went on at EPA. Forgot we have other people to talk about. Anyway, Laura.
Nothing today.
I have nothing to
report
today.
Jeff.
Nothing for me today.
Joe.
Good morning. Nothing today.
Okay. Well, and I went out.
Yeah, Paul covered everything very well. Left nothing to be discussed.
My apologies for disrupting the meeting.
Okay, with that, we'll go to agenda item 4, which is the action calendar. Agenda item 4A is approve and authorize a memorandum of understanding between Eastern Municipal Water District and International Brotherhood of the Electrical Workers, Local 1436. Laura, thank you.
And Laura, as you give your presentation, you might want to recite which slide you're on so Director Record can be on that slide, please.
Thank you. Good morning, President Fulton, members of the board. Before I get started, I'd like to introduce to you the newly elected President and Business Manager, Jeremy Waters, who's here today. I want to commend him for his professionalism through the whole negotiation efforts, and his team worked really hard to get to this point. But I wanted you to put a face to the name since he's been newly elected to this position.
Nice to see you.
Oh yeah, he runs the Desalters as well as he does the governance of the IDEW. So.
I just wanted to thank you guys for your time and your consideration on the package. You know, these things are never easy, but through a lot of creative friction, we always seem to figure out a way to come to an agreement. And we think it's a good package. We're encouraging our members to look at it as a package as a whole, as a good package, as providing stability and a step forward. I want to thank my team and thank management's team. Sometimes it can get heated in there, but I think we always treated each other with respect and kept the lines of communication open. Nice to meet you all, and thank you for your consideration.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Do you want to introduce Brian as part of the team?
Brian Rains is also here, and he's part of the negotiation team as well. Thank you for your efforts, Brian.
Yep.
Thank you.
So, just to give you a little bit of a background, our last MOU expired December 31st of last year, so we've been operating on the terms and conditions of the MOU, but no other terms going forward. Negotiations started August 2019, and we continued to go through that process, and we came to a tentative agreement this past March 18th. The union, because of the current situation with a majority or 270 employees working from home status, the union is going to be conducting a vote via electronically. So they're going to be sending a link to their membership. It's confidential, and they'll be putting those votes together, and it'll be going out next week, Monday the 6th through the 8th, and we'll have the final results on the 9th. If approved, the MOU being presented here today and the provisions are effective March 29th through December 31st, 2021. So some of the key provisions, I'm not going to go over all of them, but are listed within the board letter for your review. Key compensation and benefit provisions that are within the tentative agreement is a cost of living adjustment, which we implemented and had board approval for year 2020. Amongst that side letter were some provisions that we agreed to with the union to continue negotiating on. For year 2021 will be based on the actual change in CPI. And deferred compensation match, the agreement provides for a 1% increase to the deferred comp match for employees within the Tier 3, which are PEPRA employees at the 2.0 and 62, as well as a lower retiree medical benefit.
Slide 5.
Slide 5, the class and comp study results. One of the items is to implement the study for the classifications that are represented, consistent with the non-represented, which we implemented in October 2019. The other item is the elimination of the paper performance program. This program has been in place and provided for up to a 10% lump sum payment, and that was to recognize employees as high-performing employees. However, it has some unintended consequences, so administratively it's burdensome, as well as I think it created some friction between the employees and their supervisors. So this go around, we're eliminating the program, and in lieu of that, offering is a one-time 3% adjustment to the salary schedule, which would be put in place January 2021. I think this is a change that most other organizations that have had similar programs in place have also made. Slide 6, vision insurance, the enhancement for district coverage from employee only to family. The optional alternate plan for dental, we offer, the district pays fully for a basic plan for Delta Dental for all employees. And there's been an alternate plan in place for the last through the last MOU. The change in this would be that we would add coverage for dental implants and still remain paid by the difference paid by the employee. Slide 7, tuition reimbursement. It's increasing it from $4,200 to $5,250 per calendar year. This had not been adjusted for 10 years. We also took a look at other comparable agencies and feel this is a good change. It's a positive to encourage our employees to continue their education. The other item is the safety shoe allowance. It will be increased from $175 to $200. And also making a provision for some groups to reserve that, for them to receive the reimbursement twice a year. That's for construction groups that, you know, are in the hole, get their feet wet, have an extra pair of shoes to be available for them. Other key provisions that are not as notably financially are the standby rate. We took a look at comparable agencies and felt that was the appropriate move. Extended overtime over 4 hours, we've linked that to the travel per diem that is afforded within the administrative code. Expanded the bereavement leave for some categories, providing a one-day benefit for those categories like sister-in-law, brother-in-law. Floating holiday carryover, and have designated Easter as a holiday for those that work, so we do have approximately 35 employees that are here on the weekends and are working those holidays. The uniform policy enhancement, some changes to some groups and the ability for them to take advantage of t-shirts, and the compensatory time accruals is just some changes administratively. Next ones are key amended and policy provisions. This is slide 10. So we have a new policy that's being put in place. We felt it was important to have this in place to prioritize the protection of employees and the public. This requires any employee who's been arrested or incarcerated to report that to their supervisors or human resources. We'll then make an analysis as to the charges and how it relates to the work duties here in the district. We felt that was a good move. The other changes in the ethics policy in regards to intellectual property protection clearly defined the items that fall into that, and the prohibits the use of intellectual or confidential information for their own use. The union paid release time clearly defined what time the district will continue to pay wages and benefits for those employees that are representing employees through a meet and confer or negotiations or any disciplinary actions or grievances. We also came to an agreement with the union in regards to union business time allowance. So at any given month, 25 hours of aggregate hours, that's for them to be able to put time and effort towards maybe putting information together for the membership. And so we came to that agreement. So overall, the MOU package, the financial impact for the full term of the proposed MOU, which goes beyond the current approved budget. This is slide 12, I'm sorry for those of you on the phone. The proposed MOU comes to a 2.4 financial impact above what's already budgeted, and the remaining 6 months would be included in the next biannual budget. So overall, it's a 1.2% of total wages and benefits within the 2 years, and we feel like it could be absorbed through the current budget and format. So today what we're asking for is authorization for you to approve and authorize the general manager to execute the agreement should the union receive an affirmative vote by April 9th, and also extend the terms and conditions of the MOU to non-represented employees as we have in the past. And I'm here to answer any questions that you may have.
I think also worth noting, we, as you know, briefed the board as we went through the labor negotiation process. The financial information that's in here and the costs associated with the implementation of the new MOU are consistent with what we provided in those briefings to the board.
Yeah, my only comment was, you know, the board's been briefed thoroughly on this negotiation for the past probably 3 months. And I think everybody on the board felt strongly that, you know, as certainly the benefits is a good package, and some of the policy issues we supported really 100%. We thought that was going to be in the best interest of not only the employees that are here, but also everybody that's on the outside on some of these policy issues that we brought up. And so I want to thank the negotiating team. I want to thank Jeremy and his group for, you know, helping lead this to get to this. We have one more thing to get through, and that's for a vote. And so we hope that vote is in the affirmative. And so is there any other comments from any of the other directors? Randy, you have any comments?
I did echo your thoughts, President Slotson. I'll move the item.
Second the item.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Can I have a roll call, please?
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slotson?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
It's been moved unanimously. Thank you. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
With that, we'll go to 5B, which is adopt a resolution of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District providing for the issuance of the refunding water and wastewater revenue bonds, Series 2020A, and approved financing documents. Charles.
Good morning.
We're happy to see you.
This is like all my don't clutch those drawers.
I prefer the word just make it sparkling.
Yes.
Maybe it help make it a little sparkle over here. Good morning, everyone. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and represent the financing team and working on that. I know at the beginning of the roll call there was introductions, but I do want to thank Ryan Forbath from Stanley Yaka, our bond counsel, disclosure counsel is on the phone, and Darren Hodge, our financial advisor from PFM. They've led this effort with many members on our financing team. I'll talk about them later in my presentation. But, their efforts have been to pull together the documents associated with this opportunity for the district. And Thomas Hayes has been an orchestrator of all of this, so I want to acknowledge him for doing this in such an interesting time and doing it in such an accelerated process because we do want to capitalize on an opportunity. Before I get into the specifics of what we're asking for today, I just wanted to just remind the board that the district is well positioned financially. It has great opportunities for great policies that have been set, and we talked about our last board meeting. And Paul mentioned in the email earlier this week to all staff about our financial position. So rest assured we are well positioned and ready for these types of emergencies because of the financial practices we put into place. But this opportunity is something that we want to capitalize on. It's going above and beyond. We feel that our debt portfolio is really well tuned. It's ready to weather many different types of events. But when you do have these types of events where interest rates do come down as low as they have, this is just a further optimization of that debt portfolio. If we are able to do this, it's kind of like refinancing your house when interest rates go really low. So we're looking at this as an opportunity to refinance at the lowest interest rates possible. And that this refinancing is something that's subject to market conditions. The interest rates, they've been very volatile the last 2 or 3 weeks. I'll have some graphs about that. But in general, if the rates do go back to where we saw them at our admin committee meeting earlier in March, we see that there's a great opportunity for us to fix out some of our variable interest rates, kind of safeguard the district from any volatility going forward, and preserving optionality to finance the variable rate in the future. So we see it as a kind of a opportunity that if we can capitalize on it, great, and if the markets go away from us, it's fine. We're still really, really well positioned either way. So I just want to provide you with that backdrop. So with the specifics of our financing, I'm sure you've all seen a lot of market information lately between the Dow Jones markets and other financial markets. But the interesting component for us as a district from our financing is really municipal bond interest rates. What's happened is that when we came to our admin committee in early March, we talked about interest rates being at historic lows, and this is on our long-term interest rates. They were the lowest they've ever been. And that literally was about 3 weeks ago. And then since that moment in time, we actually had a real surge in interest rates. What happened in municipal bonds was a decoupling from this traditional rate association with other fixed income products, such as U.S. Treasury bills. What has occurred is markets and investors in these markets have gotten very panicked as it relates to any investments. There's been a dislocation in their associations between historic norms and certain investments relative to the stability of a U.S. Treasury. We actually have seen in these graphs, just trying to illustrate in the bottom right corner, that we had a real stable long-term rates up until the beginning of March, and then we saw our rates spike all the way from around 1% and went all the way to 3.5% all in a period of about 4 days. So exceptional volatility. People were basically taking their money out of highly rated, I mean, triple-A rated municipal bonds and selling them to put their money into cash. It's very rare that these occurrences happen. These typically occur during a crisis. Last time we saw something like this was in 2008. What happens, though, is typically the markets realize they overreacted. They reposition, and with the first investments that they come back to are the AAA rated investments. So we're starting to see people come back to this, realizing that they've sold too much. They're coming back. So you're starting to see on the graph the rates are coming back down. So literally in the span of 2 weeks, we've seen it go up by 200 basis points, a 2% swing, and now it's come all the way back down to where we were 3 weeks ago. So through all of this process, we're right back to where we thought we were. We're pretty close to being in the money as of today. The markets will continue, though, to be volatile over the next several weeks. So what we're trying to offer is a position where the board authorizes us to potentially fix out components of our variable rate debt, depending on where the rates are. And we have an opportunity over the next several months to be able to time it just right. So we don't have a specific date that we're going to do this. It's really just depending on the markets and the volatility, we can execute it and be agile as we work with our team. So on the short-term interest rates, what we're looking to do on this transaction is fix out or lock in long-term rates relative to variable rates. The variable rates are actually a great product. We've enjoyed the benefits of variable rates for over 25 years. The chart on the left just kind of shows the rates have been. The actual rate has been around 1.6% on average for the last 20-some-odd years. But as you can see, some of these spikes, when it gets volatile, it gets very volatile. I remember in 2008, during the crisis, we had variable rates going over 8%. When you're trending around 2% and then suddenly you're 8, that can be quite alarming and jarring and shocking when it relates to how you have stability in your system. The ways we mitigate that is we only have 30% of our debt in this variable rate product to manage these. But what we also see, though, is if you can get your, if you can lock in your rate at that average, why go through all of this? Why go through the volatility if you can really fix that out? We've never seen that opportunity before. The long-term rates have typically been much higher than this. So now in the last few months, they've really come down to a level where we can almost fix in the historic norm. So that's generally what we're trying to do. And our team has been working really hard to see all the mechanics of making that work. And we realize that at the minimum, we have one piece of it that can't be done today. But we could potentially fix up all of our variable rate debt that's associated with we call it variable rate demand obligation. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. So this is our risk, we're calling it a de-risk opportunity, our variable rate debt fix out. Some of the benefits of this is improving our portfolio risk profile. We have interest rate certainty. We no longer have to deal with this weekly or daily resetting. We improve our credit profile. The rating agencies really look at it. If you do have fixed rate, it gives you less issues as it relates to someone owning those bonds and handing them back to you, which is a risk associated with variable rate debt. And it gives you flexibility in the future. If you have all fixed rate debt today, in the future you can issue more variable rate debt. So for in 10 years from now, if we have a larger project and we need to issue it, if interest rates were really high at that time, we could potentially issue variable rate debt at a lower rate. That gives you that financial flexibility. If you have all your variable rate debt today and you don't change it, you have a certain limitation of how much more you can issue. So those are some of the flexibility options you get by fixing that today. So that there are downsides to it. It does eliminate some of our optionality that once you set it, you kind of set it and it's there. But you can restructure it in 10 years. And I also believe that we can always adjust our debt portfolio again for future financings with variable rates. So you kind of continue to have that optionality, you're just doing it a different way. So as I mentioned, we do have opportunities to do some fix outs today. We've seen our interest rates go on variables go as high as 10% in the last week, but they've now come back down on the variable rate side. So we're starting to see that we're starting to see favorable returns to the capital markets and buying these municipal bonds. So just talking about the targets on slide five, again, about 27% of our portfolio is unhedged variable rate debt. The way we're going to do this, because we don't have the exact interest rates at this point in time, is we're setting targets for the district to execute this transaction. And by hitting those different targets, we'll decide what scale we're going to do. We could fix up all $250 million of variable rate demand obligations that are currently unhedged, but we're not sure at this time whether all of it will be available and make economic sense. So our parameters are based on a transaction size of at least $50 million to have economies of scale. At an interest rate cost that would be up to 2.25% overall. A debt service that would not increase by more than $2 million in 1 year. Reason why I say that we could increase is because of the way it's structured and the debt gets refunded. You could have fixed out some interest rate costs to now that wouldn't have been an obligation today. So, and I have a graph to show that. But basically, we're trying to ensure that we have no budget impacts and no ratepayer impacts by doing a restructure refunding today. Overall, though, that will have a reduction in the interest cost over time. And then finally, we have a coupon component, which is just about how can we preserve our ability to refund fixed rate bonds in 10 years. So those are some of the moving parts to it. We've worked with our team, said these are parameters. If you can meet these objectives, we're interested in doing a fix out. They're saying that there's at least one financing right now with $50 million size that is available, and it could be an opportunity to do. But we could do all the way to $250 million if the market adjusts a little bit more and more to be favorable for us to economically refi all of them. So those are our swing of $50 to $250 million overall. So in summary, as I mentioned, there are some that are in the, we call it in the money at this point in time. We have parameters, it's the one highlighted in green, but it could be potentially all of these could and consolidate and come back to a 2.25% fixed rate component. So it is subject to a lot of market volatility, but we do have a really great team who's able to get into the market, and we'll be talking with them on a daily basis to see if today's the right day, and if not, is tomorrow the right day, and we'll continue to monitor and see when the right time would be to meet these targets. And finally, as I mentioned, our debt service profile. So the blue line, all the blue lines, our existing debt service profile. Again, that's a forecast. That line can move because we have variable rate debt within it. So that dark blue line would go up. What we're proposing to do is make it a little more certain with a fix out. What we would do is we take out components of the variable rate debt, which is highlighted in the green. And that green would now be the fixed component of our debt service. And so there might be slightly higher in certain areas relative to today's variable rate debt, but we would be absolutely set at that level. We would not be going any higher than that, which is the risk that we currently have today with variable rate exposure. So we hope that helps illustrate a little bit about how this helps us in managing our debt over time. The second opportunity is a little less likely, but we want to put it out there as an option just in case. We do have a synthetic hedge, these are swaps related to other variable rate debt, and one of those is it's called a LIBOR-based swap. And well, I'm sorry, Rita, I haven't been playing on our page numbers. On page eight here, we're talking about the swap is itself indexed to the London Interbank Offering Rate, and that rate is scheduled to go out of existence or be used in 2021. And so this may be an opportunity for us to move away from that exposure to that LIBOR index at an affordable price. And what would it entail would be we basically issue bonds to pay out that swap. We would just basically be replacing that synthetic obligation agreement with an actual bond. And we think that makes sense under certain conditions. Interest rates have to be right, and you also need to ensure that the overall debt service is similar. So you're basically not paying more than what you would have paid anyway. And you do present value analysis to see whether that makes sense. So our financing team, PFM, will be doing all the analysis to see if there are opportunities to do that in conjunction with the option one of variable rate refunding. At this point in time, it doesn't seem to be making sense to us, but it may. Over the next couple of weeks, we'll continue to monitor and see. So that's the second option. I don't count on that one becoming viable, but we're hopeful. And if it does, we'd like to have authority to go ahead and refund that out and continue to fix in our current rates, but with an actual bond instead of a swap. The other swap that we have, just to be mindful, is that one is actually going to mature on July 1, 2020. So if this all works out, we will have no more swaps on our balance sheet, no more risk associated with counterparties, and all that basis and interest rate risk associated with LIBOR for 2021. So those are our two options. Our recommendations for the board's consideration is in our staff report. We have a variety of bond documents for the board's consideration. It includes our preliminary official statement, the Appendix A, which provides a significant amount of updated disclosure about the district. We wanted to share a little bit some of the highlights and some of the changes we've added to it since the last time we came to the board a year or so ago. We have updated with a coronavirus 19 update, talking about that risk profile. We've given an update about Fallbrook and Rainbow, a little about that de-annexation, the potential coming to Eastern. We have updates as it relates to the surface area itself, the groundwater basins, and all of the SGMA components. We also have updates related to our interest within Metropolitan and Metro Met's current budget. All the timely updates through today we've provided as part of the board's recommendation. And we've also included all of our other contracts and associated with the transaction. We're asking the board to approve and authorize for the general manager, Laura, or myself, to be able to execute those documents. And then with the board approval, the next steps would be that next Wednesday and Thursday, we have scheduled conference calls with the rating agencies. It's an interesting time to be talking with them. We would fly to San Francisco, sit in a room and meet with them and kind of give them a good overview of the successes of Eastern, really get them to understand us. And this time we're going to be in conference calls with them while we're sitting at their homes and talking a little bit more about it. So we're going to try to make it more interesting with some PowerPoints and conference calls. But we're optimistic. We're going to be able to share with them that Eastern's credit is very strong. They were in the face of a crisis, but we've managed many others in the past. We continue to weather the storms. We continue to have great financial metrics and a great position, and continue to merit a very strong credit rating. With that, after that presentation, we're asking them to provide us a rating by April 20th. And then on April 20th, and then any day thereafter, we can enter in the market and execute this transaction. So that's a summary of our recommendations and our timeline. We have our team that's on the call. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer those, or our team can field them as well.
Have any questions?
Charles, on our ratings, and in your opinion or the team's opinion, being that we are in a revenue base of wastewater, water, recycling water, do you think we're going to be in a better position than municipalities that simply relying on property tax and sales tax?
Yeah, it's a really great question. We actually had a conference call this week, the whole team talking about our ratings and got their input. Our banking team, advisory team, they also represent clients, schools, cities, counties, and others, airports, convention centers, others that are really having struggles in this moment dealing with financing. They all look at us like, you guys are really a gem. You guys are in a really great spot. You're positioned well. You're essential service. A utility is considered the number one credit as it comes to municipalities. That's why we've been able to continue to earn such great credit strength. But there are a lot of concerns about the broader economy and getting the rating analysts to kind of remember that, to get past the global issue, the national issues, some of the county or statewide issues, to get back to the essential credits, or really the strongest credits of the entire mix. That's our job. So we'll go next week to explain that to them and remind them of that. We're optimistic, because even during 2008, we were able to remind them of that. They believed in us, and we continue to get rating upgrades through that. During the drought, we had to remind them we're going to continue to weather this, even with 30% reduction in demand. We still have financial strength, and they gave us a rating increase. So I can't promise a rating increase on this one, but I can say that we're going to be able to illustrate the essential credits like us have a better position than some of the schools and others. But we're also very mindful that the schools, counties, and others are going to be impacted. Our economics are going to be impacted, and we're going to show them that our projections actually reflect some of those considerations and bringing back our longer-term projections for the next 5 years. But we're still recognizing that our financial position is very strong.
Well, I have a lot of faith in you and your team, so thank you.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, I do have a question. Charles, the changes you were talking about, the variable and the synthetic, those are covered with this action?
All of these are, as part of the recommendation, all of those are impacted in the sense that we would basically refund variable rate debt with fixed rate debt.
Right.
So we're not adding any new debt. We're not expanding our debt. We're not asking for any new money, no new loans. We're just replacing an existing variable rate loan with a fixed rate loan. That's really what we're asking for.
All right.
And the thing is, we don't know exactly the amount yet, so we're asking for anywhere from about $50 million to $250 million of replacement loans.
Right, so you and your team will have to be ready to pull the trigger any given time?
Yeah, I think we've had plenty of text messages, phone calls, anywhere from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. of where the market is at this moment, so we're ready to go at any moment.
Well, I'm glad you guys are doing it and not me. So, I support this. Thank you.
Yeah, I do too. I think wherever we have an opportunity like this, and Laura and Charles and Tom, that when we can get rid of some of the risk of variable rate debt and get down to something that's at a low level, kind of guarantees where we are. I think it's terrific, and also maybe with the opportunity of getting rid of a swap. I know one's going to exit. I think it's very positive as to what your team's doing. I appreciate that. Have any other questions or comments from directors?
No, I think the things that we need to do, get more fixed rate interest and go from there.
Yeah, I think with you and PFM, it's been terrific. I appreciate that. So with that, can we have a motion and a second?
I'll move.
It's been moved and second. We have a roll call vote, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Becker?
Aye.
All right. Motion passes unanimously with all directors present. With that, we'll go to agenda item C, which is approve and authorize award of contract with E.J. Meyer Company for $1,575,555 under specification number 1387W and for the Las Brisas Transmission Pipeline Project and an additional appropriation of $2,015,000.
Good morning, Mr. President, fellow members of the board. I'm happy to be here today to present to you our Las Brisas Transmission Pipeline Project. The project is located in the city of Murrieta. It's primarily along Las Brisas Road. It also involves Hancock Avenue. It's located just off of I-215 at Los Alamos Road. We will be constructing 2,700 linear foot of parallel 24-inch diameter steel pipeline along this area. The project involves three major interconnections at intersections and a temporary high line to keep everyone in water during construction. We'll also have robust traffic control plans and noise mitigation requirements, especially on Hancock Avenue due to the fact it's heavily traveled and close proximity to customers. By way of background, this facility, as you can see in the middle of the screen, was identified in our Water Facilities Master Plan. This facility will provide regional benefits along with the other benefits or the other improvements identified in the area, primarily the developer improvements on the west side of the zone. Those improvements related to the proposed hotel and some other adjacent developments. So with that, the facilities will provide added transmission capacity, alleviate low pressures, provide a better level of service, and better product flow. So with that, under spec 1387, we received bids in late February, and E.J. Meyer Company was the lowest responsive and responsible bid with a bid amount of $1.58 million. This is in alignment with the engineer's estimate and was in alignment, too, with the other bidders, showing that our construction documents were seen similarly and good bid documents. So with that, we look to advance the project as soon as possible and complete the project in early 2021. As you can see here on the photograph, this is the intersection of Hancock and Los Alamos Road, which will be one of our challenges when we interconnect the pipeline here. So with that, I'd like to recommend we advance a construction contract with E.J. Meyer Company with a contract amount of $1.58 million. Also, other ancillary contracts to complete the work and additional appropriation of approximately $2 million, taking the total project cost to $2.2 million. With that, I'd like to entertain any questions.
Do you have any questions?
We discussed this.
And optional engineering, that Hancock is going to be difficult. It's a tight area, number one, and it is really heavily traveled, and so some of the nighttime stuff is just going to be, especially if school gets started, you know, it's hard to get out of there in the morning and from 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock. It's just incredible.
Okay. I'll move it.
Okay. You have a second? Been moved and seconded. All in favor? Roll call vote, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Polly?
Aye.
Director Crona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Becker?
Aye.
Thank you. Motion passes unanimously. With that, we'll go to agenda item D, which is approve and authorize agreements with Woodard and Curran for $1,623,478. Kennedy Jenks for $660,174, and Converse Consultants for $166,730 for the Paris North Basin Groundwater Contamination Prevention and Remediation Program, and an additional appropriation of $4,994,022. Joe.
Good morning, Mr. President, members of the board. I'd like to provide you with an update on where we are with the Paris North Groundwater Program, as well as recommendations for the path forward. On slide number two, provide an exhibit of the location of the proposed program. As you are aware, this program involves construction of a series of groundwater extraction wells and treatment facilities located north, east, and south of the March Air Reserve Base. The groundwater in the area has a number of contaminants, and looking at slide number three, these well clusters have primarily volatile organic compounds as well as nitrates and perchlorates. So we have looked at and examined not only the contaminants, but what is the preferred treatment method for each one of these well clusters. The objective of the program is not only to remediate the groundwater contamination, but also to mitigate migration of the contaminants further south. If that were to happen, that would potentially impact not only EMWD's operating potable wells, but also the city of Paris as operating wells south of this area. In addition, we feel strongly that this program would generate a local, reliable groundwater resource for the community. We are also in negotiations and discussions with Western Municipal Water District, whereby a portion of the water produced from this program will be made available to Western, which ultimately will be provided to the March Air Reserve Base. We are finalizing the term sheet, and we will be coming back to the board for consideration of that term sheet for an agreement with Western fairly soon. In addition, as the board is aware, one of the significant benefits of this program is to mitigate the rising groundwater level at the March Air Reserve Base. That elevated groundwater conditions presents a risk in terms of liquefaction and other concerns. As you're aware, the groundwater elevation of that location is within a few feet of the surface. In fact, there's been observed surfacing of groundwater within the adjacent storm drain channels. So on slide number four, you'll see the proposed program in concept. It involves, again, drilling two wells in Moreno Valley with an anticipated production of about 2,000 acre feet per year. We've identified granular activated carbon and ion exchange as the preferred treatment method. We would also require monitoring wells for each one of these well clusters to monitor the performance of the program. There's the second well cluster that we're identifying as a Cactus Corridor wells, up to six production wells. The bedrock in this area is very shallow, thus we need more wells to extract the amount of water that we're looking to mitigate the contamination. So in concept, there will be up to four wells immediately north of the base, two wells that would be deeper than what we've identified as a subterranean canyon to the east of the base. We're targeting a production of approximately 3,700 acres per year, and we've also identified granular activated carbon as the preferred treatment. To the south, we have what we've identified as well 204. We've already acquired a property for that well. We've also acquired a property for the Moreno Valley wells, and we're in negotiation with the city of Moreno Valley on one of the east wells that we identified, Santiago well, and potentially another site that the city owns for an additional well within the Cactus Corridor cluster. So as the board is aware, last year we submitted an application to the State Water Resource Control Board seeking 50% grant funding. At the time, the program cost was estimated at approximately $73 million. We submitted an application for 50% funding in February of this year. We were notified that we are receiving the amount that we were seeking, essentially $36 million, approximately half of the program cost. Having said that, there's a very aggressive schedule associated with the funding mechanism. We have to have the program completed and operational by March of 2023. Given the complexities and magnitude of all the components of the program, it's quite aggressive, but we feel confident that we're going to be able to meet that timeline. So since being notified of the award of the grant by the state, we've held a series of meetings with the State Water Resource Control Board staff to finalize the terms and provisions of the funding agreement. Through those discussions, the state has requested additional elements to be incorporated as part of the program. We originally, for example, had included 10 monitoring wells for the program. They've asked us to increase that to 20 monitoring wells. Again, they want to be confident that we're going to be able to report adequately in the future on the performance of the contamination mitigation. In addition, they've asked us to advance additional groundwater modeling to confirm that we will not have any interference with the on-base contamination cleanup activities by the Air Force. There's also program management activities that we will need to incorporate to the program, given, again, the magnitude of this effort. We need to bring on consulting services to assist EMWD staff. We also requested the inclusion of the land acquisition costs that EMWD had previously incurred for certain wells. So that was added to the overall program cost, and that will be considered as part of our local share contribution to the program. We also escalated the construction cost to the midpoint of construction. We also took a close look at the current construction conditions, meaning with the PFAS issues, there is a premium on granular activated carbon as well as well drilling. So we took all those items into consideration. So the updated program cost that we submitted to the state recently is in the amount of just shy of $90 million. We are requesting an increase in the state board funding from $36 million to $44.9 million, almost $45 million. The state board, in our discussions, has indicated that they are willing to consider modification of the grant as long as below the $50 million threshold. So that request was submitted in mid-March. We anticipate to hear back from the state staff in the next week or two. We feel optimistic that we are going to have our request considered by the state board to increase that grant. Moving on to slide number six, this gives you a more detailed description of the additional cost components that were incorporated into the program. As I mentioned earlier, originally the total program was around $73 million. By adding the additional monitoring wells that the state requested, as well as the additional groundwater modeling, the program management services, the land acquisition costs that we had incurred in the past, and we were able to go back to 2014. And if you recall, back then is when we acquired some of the well sites up in Molina Valley for those proposed facilities. Also, we escalated the construction cost based on market conditions and to the midpoint of construction. So, again, this table on slide six represents the various components that brought the overall program to approximately $90 million. So, having said that, we wanted to go back and take a look. What does that translate in terms of cost per foot? As you can see here on slide number seven, given the current estimate of $90 million, based on 50% grant funding from the state, we then took our share of the capital, which is approximately $45 million. If we amortize that capital, that would equate to approximately $2.4 million per year. Then we looked at the anticipated annual operation maintenance cost of the program, and that's approximately $2.3 million. So when you combine that annual cost of about $4.8 million a year, and you look at the resultant cost per foot based on production of 6,750 feet, that is $700 per acre foot. That is still significantly lower than the current metropolitan tier one rate of 1,078, about 30% below that rate from MET. And as you're aware, metropolitan is also looking at escalations of that rate in the near term. So where do we stand with the agreement? We anticipate to have a final agreement for your consideration by June of this year, possibly even May. The negotiations have gone fairly well. We're in the final stretch of those discussions. In advance of executing the agreement, the funding agreement, the state has requested that we complete the CEQA. So Al Hadi and his team have already initiated CEQA efforts on all the well clusters. They also wanted us to complete the preliminary design report to affirm that the program as we put forward is in fact the best designed to remediate the contamination. So today I will be requesting that the board approve a contract with Kennedy Jenks to complete and update the preliminary design effort. The state has also requested establishment of a stakeholder advisory group as well as a technical advisory group and regular meetings of those groups to provide feedback and oversight of the program. The stakeholder advisory group, we invited the Air Force as well as the EPA, Western Municipal, and the cities of Moreno Valley and Paris. In fact, last month we held our first stakeholder advisory group as well as technical advisory group. The technical advisory group includes the state board, the regional board, our staff, as well as Western Municipal Water District. Again, part of the agreement, as I mentioned, we will go ahead and advance additional groundwater modeling to affirm the non-interference between our proposed program and the existing on-base groundwater cleanup activities by the Air Force. Ultimately, this is going to lead to an operating and monitoring program that we will be providing to the state, and we will be reporting on an annual basis over the next 20 years on performance of this program. So as you can see here on slide number 9, there are multiple concurrent activities that have to be advanced in order to complete the overall program by March of 2023. Currently, not only are we looking at the necessary permitting to advance infrastructure, but also, as I mentioned earlier, we've initiated discussions with the Air Force, specifically General Manager Paul Jones, Jolene Walsh, and myself were back in D.C. Back in February. We met with the Pentagon representatives to discuss the program. We thought the meeting was well received. We communicated the benefits to the March Air Reserve Base, primarily our proposed joint operational plan with the Air Force, meaning that we are committing and we are proposing that we would operate this proposed program in a fashion where it does not interfere with the groundwater extraction and cleanup that's currently being conducted on base. We also requested that we reach an agreement with the Air Force where we agree not to litigate any type of potential issues down the road, as well as we highlighted that this program has the benefit of not only lowering the groundwater level below the base, but potentially that has a nexus to the spread of PFAS in the region. We ourselves have sampled and monitored water that's surfacing in the adjacent storm channel. We detected PFAS. We believe there may be a benefit to the Air Force as well in terms of mitigating that migration of PFAS. So I know Jolene has reached out to the individuals we met with at the Pentagon. We're in the process of setting up a follow-on discussion. They're obviously talking to their legal counsel regarding our request. In addition to that item, as I mentioned, our staff, Al Javier and his team, and Linnea and others, are working diligently to advance the CEQA compliance. John Ward and his team are looking at the additional property that we need to acquire and negotiating with the City of Moreno Valley and others to acquire those remaining sites that we need. And, of course, we need to advance the preliminary and final design for this program. And then construction will be initially commenced with the well drilling, and then later we will advance the wellhead facilities, treatment facilities, and the associated pipelines with the objective of completing the entire program by March 2023. So as I mentioned, we will need support services to complete this effort. We issued a request for proposals in December for program management services. We started with Wooden and Curran, and we negotiated services by Wooden and Curran for over the next 3 years to help us complete this overall program in the amount of $1.6 million. If you recall, Wooden and Curran was a consultant that's been assisting EMW over the last 2 years in not only groundwater modeling associated with this specific program, but overall planning services and program definition. So they're very well positioned to continue to assist us with the overall program management. In addition, we've negotiated a scope of work and fee with Kennedy Jenks Consultants to provide us with the preliminary design reports for the various well clusters. That effort was negotiated in the amount of $660,000. That includes field survey. They will be retaining Cozen and Fox to perform that work. Again, as you may recall, KJ has been assisting us with infrastructure planning and definition on this program over the last 2 years. We also, as I mentioned earlier, we will need additional groundwater modeling, so we are proposing an amendment with Witter and Curran to provide the additional effort that the State Water Resource Control Board has requested. Also, we will need to advance geotechnical investigations. We've negotiated with Converse Consultant, who is on our call, who is one of our on-call consultants that's on the geotech category. They were previously competed for this type of work, so we have negotiated a scope of work and effort in the amount of $166,000. There are other program services that we need to advance. For example, we need to develop the construction documents for drilling up to the 9 extraction wells that I described earlier. There's also property appraisals that have to be conducted, phase 1 analysis for property acquisitions and due diligence that have to be performed. There's also utility location and potholing services that have to be conducted. And of course, as we execute the funding agreement with the state, there will be reporting requirements that will be have to be performed on a regular basis. And all of that is described on slide number 11. So moving on to slide number 12, in terms of overall program next steps, as I mentioned, we are in the process of completing the CEQA. In fact, we'll be back in front of the board here fairly soon to present a recommendation to adopt the CEQA documents that are being developed. We are also negotiating with the City of Moorhead Valley on 2 well sites, and again, once we near conclusion of that, we will be coming back in front of the board for approval. And we will be advancing the additional groundwater modeling, advertising contracts for drilling of the wells, completing the preliminary design reports, finalizing the term sheet with Western for supply of project water to Western and the March Air Reserve Base. And again, we'll be coming back to the board with those terms for consideration and approval. And as I mentioned earlier, we're also continuing our dialogue with the Air Force regarding the joint operational agreement, as well as the commitments to not litigating any potential future issues. In terms of the grant, we are finalizing the terms, and we are very optimistic that we'll have a final agreement with the state by May, June timeframe. In fact, we've provided them with our final edits and comments. They're going through review with their legal counsel at this time. And of course, we'll continue to hold regular technical advisory committee meetings and stakeholder advisory committee meetings for feedback and input as we develop the program. So, staff's recommendation is to award a contract to Wooden and Curran in the amount of $1.6 million for program management services, a separate contract with Kennedy James in the amount of $660,000 for preliminary design, a contract with Converse Consultants for geotechnical services in support of the program, and administrative award and execution for other professional services contracts and agreements to advance the Paris North Basin groundwater contamination remediation program. We are requesting appropriation of $4.99 million, almost $500 million, to support all the activities that are described, in addition to staff time to advance the program. With that, I just wanted to note one final thing is that, as you can imagine, a program of this magnitude and complexity requires the effort of numerous departments and work groups throughout the district. And I just want to acknowledge everyone from engineering, planning, real property division, operation, maintenance, finance. As you can imagine, everyone across this entire enterprise has had to help advance this massive program, and I just want to express my appreciation. With that, I'll be more than happy to answer any questions you have.
Do you have any questions?
I have a question. I was just kind of wondering on the Air Force side, what is their plan, their mitigation plan? I mean, because we have to coordinate with them, and you know how government works, how quickly they will move on it, and we're going to go. But how quickly are they going to, and how does that create a potential problem if, you know, if we get done with our project, we start pumping, you know, is there going to be stuff migrating over to our side, that kind of thing?
A great question, Dr. Perron. So currently, there are on-site contamination programs on the base. The base historically has had certain plumes that they've been trying to mitigate. They have what's called an EGET system, Enhanced Groundwater Extraction Treatment System. They currently have these shallow wells around the perimeter of the Marsh Air Reserve Base. They extract around 150 to 200 gallons per minute. It's a fairly limited extraction system. They do have plans to expand that system and drill additional wells, but it's still a fairly limited extraction program compared to what we're describing here as far as EM50's program. Those plumes have, in fact, migrated off base to some degree, and they do extensive monitoring of where the delineation of those plumes. Our position is that our program, based on our groundwater model and the additional modeling that we are proposing to do, will not interfere with those plumes. We are also proposing to not only share data, but obviously incorporate whatever groundwater monitoring and sampling. We're also requesting access on base to do additional field investigations. So we're basically requesting a full collaboration with the Air Force to make certain that the groundwater modeling that we develop satisfies not only our need, but also provides the level of confidence to the state and to the Air Force that we're not going to have an interference between our proposed program and theirs. I think our proposal for a joint operational plan, as well as essentially a release, is beneficial to all involved, the Air Force and the EMWD. So that's our preferred approach going forward. I don't know, Paul, if you'd like to add.
Yeah, I think to that extent, as Joe pointed out, a key component of that is going to be this coordinated operations agreement. So I think the ideal from a practical standpoint is we would do very extensive groundwater modeling of our proposed project and how it would operate. We would then ask for similar data from the Air Force for their expanded EGET system. We'd do a technical review and coordination and then design the, for example, the extraction rates in our wells to be complementary to their operations. That being said, modeling is not what actually happens in the field, so we anticipate in the coordinated operations agreement there would be, if the plumes were to move in directions not anticipated by the modeling, or there was interference of our project by the Air Force or by the Air Force's project by us, that we would have a process included in the agreement to do basically an adaptive management process where we would meet, confer, look at the operations, make adjustments in the operations in good faith, and then move forward. And to Joe's point, and then have something in the agreement that said, under those circumstances, we're not just going to start suing each other. Does that...
Yeah, you know, I think that and the state's willingness, I think the state realizes that this could end up being some issues down the line. I think that's why they've are basically wanting to increase the funding to allow for some additional wells to be sunk, some additional monitoring to happen, because it's in the best interest of everybody, also the state of California, because they're putting up a significant amount of money. And so, you know, we're doing the best protection that we can, I think, in everybody's behalf. And I feel strongly that Senator Feinstein's newly hired military legislative lady is going to weigh in significantly on this to sort of move this Air Force thing to a successful conclusion. Her, in addition to Congressman Calvert's office, I think, you know, will do well. We have a motion and a second, and if we don't have any other comments?
I'll move approval.
I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauley?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Thank you. Motion approves unanimously. We'll go to agenda item 4E, which is approve and authorize an award of contract with Schneider Electric Systems USA for $3,607,608 for phase two of the Integrated Operations Center Supervisory Control Data Acquisition Control System upgrade project, and approve the total project cost in the amount not to exceed $4,855,500. All right.
I'm here today to discuss the ISD SCADA upgrade project. Go to slide two. I'm going to give you an overview of our current SCADA system and what we're proposing for the upgrade project, and then we'll discuss cost estimate and schedule and recommendation. So our supervisory control and data acquisition system, this data system, allows us to bring real-time data from the field into one common place, into our integrated operations center, and where they can monitor and use real-time data to make decisions based on what we see. On slide four, you'll see this is our IFC. It is staffed 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and monitors everything. We'll call out our maintenance staff, the water operations staff, as needed to respond. And they can monitor everything that we have from our facilities here in Twin Fishing. On slide five, this is an example of one of our existing screens that we have. So when we go to dissipation, it's important that we see how everything's interacting because we're pumping water from a couple different locations. On this screen, you can see, it's kind of smaller, but we can see the Mekita, part of the RF, Palomar, Reach 4, and then the dissipator itself. So the ISC can continuously monitor what's going on there. So throughout the district, we have nearly 300 facilities that have remote terminal units or the RTUs, and treatment plants, freshwater plants, lift stations, tanks, etc. On slide six, we're proposing a system upgrade because our existing hardware and software that support our system are nearly obsolete. So our hardware is nearly 9 years old. So for our servers, the expected life of the server would be 5 to 7 years, and we're at 9 years. And our software is no longer going to be supported. So it's important that we upgrade it to keep our system operational and also to meet the improved cybersecurity measures that are required. On slide seven, you can see that the board approved and authorized phase one of the SCADA upgrade project in May of 2019. The goal of that was to plan the engineering effort to actually implement the phase two software upgrades, hardware upgrades also. Slide 8 discusses the summary of phase 1. So we needed to define the RTU protocols, security measures, cybersecurity measures, the design of the screens, and everything that went into that, system security. And then, as it says, there are also the cybersecurity gaps identified by the YCDOs. As part of that, they also developed the scope for phase 2. Some of the advantages to upgrading the system to the Snyder Electric OASIS DNA is for long-term planning. This allows us a period to actually move forward and work towards a more open system, where right now we're kind of tied down with our RTUs because of our communication. We have our terrain makes it such that we need RTUs to communicate through repeaters back here, and this will give us some time to work through that with the microwave backbone. It also provides us a lower cost because the conversion. Basically, we can take our old screens and convert them straight over to the new system. So that's going to be cost savings as well as a reduced schedule. And then we have district staff that already support this, already create screens, and we're able to work on the system. So that lowers the risk because it's not a new system that we're getting into. It's something that we've used for quite a while. So on slide 10, we want to make sure that we're on the right path. So we retained Black Beach to come in and do third-party assessment. We wanted them to review the scope of work, maybe identify some different SCADA platforms that we could use, and then also help us with some long-term planning. We know that we have some planning things coming up. For instance, our RTUs have been in place for nearly 20 years. They started being installed 20 years ago, so they've had a good life, and we're going to need to look forward to replacing those in the coming years. So they made some recommendations for that, and they did confirm our recommendation that upgrading to the OASIS, the new OASIS platform is the proper path for us. So our phase two scope of work will provide, on site level, provide the development, purchase, and installation of the software system itself, and address all cybersecurity gaps. So on this, you can see the screen. It's gray, it's kind of plain compared to some of the other fancy screens you might see, but we want it to be that one on purpose. We want that if the ILC receives an alarm, we want that to stand out to them. And they found in the past where there have been some industrial incidents, the screen was so busy that the alarm did not stand out to them. And we want an alarm, a fail alarm or anything like that, to stand out to our operators
and DASD. So the seed screen DASD will be different in that respect if you guys would visit that. So we also wanted to review, since we're using Center Electric, that we have a fair cost proposal to the district. So we did review the proposal based on previous proposals, and it's in line with what previous proposal costs. We also had Black and Beach look at the costs, and they believe that given the scale, that their costs were appropriate, the scale of the project was appropriate. And so based on the price investigation and our relationship with Snyder, we're confident we're receiving a fair and reasonable price for those scale upgrades. On slide 13, you can see the project cost estimate. It includes phase one, which was our Black Beach assessment, and Snyder Electric Services, and Westfield Cybersecurity. And then it includes phase two, which is labor, hardware, taxes. We have some cabling installation costs, and then also EMFD labor, which is SCADA staff and IT staff, and along with contingency. So the total project cost, estimated project cost for phase two is $4.48 million approximately, and the overall project cost is $4.85 million. So we have a schedule for phase two. We hope to execute the contract, which is approved today, execute the contract by May of 2020, and then immediately start on display development and database migration. With the completion date of February 2022. Slide 15 shows our future long-term SCADA system planning project. So number one, there is upgraded SCADA system that's going to allow us to continue running and start planning. And the biggest portion of this is the microwave improvements. The microwave improvements are going to allow us to install different hardware and open our bidding more to more vendors so that we can actually receive competitive pricing going forward. Right now, we're tied to Kingfisher because of the protocol that we're using. It's been a very good RT, but we'd like to get it where we're more open and can expand our field a little bit. So we want to start working towards our vision and planning and then towards the RT replacement plan, develop the plan, and then over a period of 6 to 7 years, work on replacing our RTUs. That'll come after the microwave. So our recommendation is for the board to approve and authorize a contract with Snyder Electric for approximately $3.6 million, and then also approve the overall total project cost of approximately $4.85 million. Are there any questions?
Do you have any questions?
Almost staff's recommendation. I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded. Roll call vote, please.
Dr. Sullivan?
Aye.
Dr. Pauly?
Aye.
Director Crono?
Aye.
Director Slotson?
Aye.
Director Riker?
Aye.
Thank you. Motion passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good job.
Agenda item 4F is the repeal of the Fourth Amendment to the General Manager's Employment Contract. Paul?
Thank you, President Sullivan.
Just for a second. After this, we're going to take a brief thing here and go to the financing authority meeting, and then shortly, and at the conclusion of that, we'll take a 10-minute break. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, President Sullivan, members of the board. On February 10th, I announced my intention to retire from the district, and subsequent to that, work with the board to develop a succession plan and recruitment and transition to a new general manager. As part of that, and to complement that succession plan, I came to the board on February 19th with a Fourth Amendment to my employment contract with the district, and that was approved by the board at that time. Obviously, things have changed a little bit since February 19th, and I think we've seen so much significant disruption and uncertainty caused by the COVID-19 outbreak that based on my consultation with the executive committee and the members of the board, I think the consensus is that initiating an executive recruitment and implementing a leadership change right now is certainly not in the best interest of the organization. So as a result, I have elected to rescind my retirement and continue to be general manager of the district for the foreseeable future. Now to unwind what occurred on February 19th in terms of the Fourth Amendment, Based on my consultation with our legal counsel and board president, probably the simplest way to continue my employment here would just be to repeal that Fourth Amendment of my employment contract. That would then put the Third Amendment of my contract in place. That's attached to your package. I do want to point out that Third Amendment was authorized by the board in 2017, and it has a term that runs through November 1st, 2022. Also in that Third Amendment, it has my salary that was in place at the time of the Third Amendment in 2017. I've had a couple of adjustments to my salary based on the board's review of my appraisal. So the action today would be, with the understanding that I am not getting a pay cut, that I will be at my current salary, and hopefully that's going to be okay with the board. So with that, I just ask the board consideration of repealing the Fourth Amendment to the employment contract and reaffirming the Third Amendment to that contract as presented. Can I answer any questions?
Have any questions or comments from?
I move approval.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved to second. And roll call vote, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauley?
Aye.
Director Crona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye, and I would like to say I appreciate Paul looking at what's going on today and offering to stay on. That's good for the district at this time.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I would certainly recommend, I would certainly second the Director of Record's comments. I just think it's, it just shows that Paul's view of things around here is in the best interest of the district and look forward to it. So
thank you. Very much.
Okay, with that, let's go to the Eastern Municipal Water District's Financing Authority regular meeting of April 1, 2020, time being after 10 a.m. So we'll call the meeting to order. Agenda item one is to for public comments. Any subject within the jurisdiction of EMWD, speakers are required to limit their comments to 3 minutes. Unless there's anybody on the phone that would wish to speak, we have no comment cards or no one's raising their hand. With that, we'll go to agenda item two, which is the approval of the minutes of the regular meeting of November the 20th, 2019, that was conducted at 10:30 a.m.
I make a motion to approve the minutes.
I will second that motion.
It's been moved and seconded. Roll call vote, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauley?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Okay, motion passes unanimously. We'll go to agenda item three, which is the action item. A, which is to adopt a resolution of the Board of Directors of Eastern Municipal Water District's Financing Authority approving the sale of its refunding water and wastewater revenue bonds series 2020A.
So it looks like I was so excited to run up here, I figured I'd attend the approval of the minutes. Apologies for that. So, as I said, President Sullivan, the action item before the authority is to adopt the resolution approving the refunding water and wastewater revenue bond series 2020A. And as was discussed and approved earlier this morning by Charles, the 2020A bonds are the bonds in a principal amount not to exceed $275 million. And they're being used to refund all or a portion of the district's variable rate debt and potential termination of the district's outstanding swap should market conditions be favorable. The reason this calls for action from the authority is because these are revenue bonds and the district is unable to issue revenue bonds. And since 2015, when the authority was established, revenue bonds have been issued under the authority to finance capital projects. In this case, we are simply asking that the authority approve the action to issue the 2020A bonds and approve the related documents, such as the installment purchase agreement, the trust indenture, the preliminary official statement, and the Appendix A, which is a current disclosure of district activities and financial position. With that said, I'm sure Charles answered most of the questions earlier, but I'd be happy to answer any other related questions.
Okay, the directors have any other questions or comments? If none,
I'll move the item.
Okay.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Rucker?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. That will adjourn the meeting to the regular meeting on Wednesday, June 17, 2020 at 10:30 a.m. With that, we'll take a 10-minute break.